Hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you missed the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I would like to introduce you to Dr. Silvia Pinheiro, who is doing research under the supervision of Dr. Valerie Kuhlmeier. Welcome to Grad Chat, Dr. Pinheiro.
Hello, Grad Chat.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we're really excited to learn all about the work that you're doing in the lab and outside of the lab as well. But kind of before we dive into your current projects, could you tell us a little bit about kind of your journey so far to your current role and what attracted you to Queen's for research in the first place?
Sure. I'm really happy to be here. It's my second time participating in a podcast, but my first one was actually in Portuguese.
Oh, amazing.
So I think this is a good starting point here. I'm from Brazil, and I came to Queen's to do my PhD a few years ago. And I've been like, it's been such a journey being here, learning so much about not only research, but like human relationships, work ethic, all of that. And I did my PhD in psychology, but I graduated in a program of biology in Brazil. I did like biology with emphasis in teaching. So I did like a, what would be here, like a teacher's college.
Oh, okay. Yes.
And I, in the end of my undergrad, I got involved like with research in neuroscience, and that's why I kind of like I transitioned into a master's of neuroscience, which I also completed in Brazil, and then here I entered in the psychology program.
Oh, very nice. So very interdisciplinary
approach
to your research. So your current research is all about children's sharing behavior online. Can you tell us a little bit about what your projects look like?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because my research was not going to be online, but we all know what happened a few years ago.
Yes, COVID.
Yeah, we are still traumatized about all of this, but that's also what happened with my research. I was not gonna collect data online, for example, but I had to, like a lot of labs around the world actually had to. A question that is really like interesting to social development is how children learn behaviors related to prosociality, which is like doing good for others, like acting in behalf of others. And most of this research was traditionally being conducted in person. And with the pandemic, a lot of researchers with different topics in developmental science started collecting data online. And then two things stood out to me. Like one of them was that, okay, as researchers, we don't know a lot about how behaviors translate or how they like express at all online, especially social behaviors. And the second is, these behaviors already exist. That's it's not a matter of the pandemic being like a thing right now when we're having to collect data online. Like kids are actively sharing with others online, resources like in games, online communities, all of this. And we are not studying enough about that. We don't understand enough. And that's another environment that they are exposed to and they grow up in this environment as well.
Yes, very. I mean, I think a lot of kids have very digital childhoods these days, right? And that's a whole other area that we haven't, well, like you said, we don't have a lot of information on. So your work's kind of looking at that. So you shared a little bit about your research online because of COVID, like many other folks. But what motivated you to study sharing behavior in children? And you hinted towards this already, but why is it so important to look at it in virtual environments?
Yeah, what motivated me, I think, was that, as I said in the beginning, in my biology program, I had the opportunity to do some placements to teach like kids in, not as young as like as I study, but like kids in like middle school and high school. And getting contact with kids like motivated me to study development as well. And my program in Brazil had a really like a really close approach to evolutionary psychology that often has perspective of looking into, like, comparing development and evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So we see, for example, children and, like, the behaviors that start to develop across time as ways to understand more about us as a species during evolution. So, for example, when we talk about sharing is really, like, widespread, like, in every human community. But it does not happen the same time in every situation.
We all
know there are so many, like, little things that make us, like, okay, am I gonna share or not with this person? How much? All these things. And this also is affected by different populations and cultures and economic settings, all of this. So the second thing was actually the first thing that motivated me to research was being, like, coming from an unequal country.
Mm.
So that motivated me to look into how these economic differences could modulate aspects of sharing. As I said, that was my initial motivation when I wanted to start study sharing, but then because I could not collect data online properly and the cross-cultural study that I envisioned having part of my PhD was not super easy to do at first, because of, like, the problems with, like, traveling restrictions
of
and,
course,
like, collaborations in general, when just we were, like, pretty busy with surviving.
Yes. Everything during COVID-19 shifted. Yes. And then to try and propose an international cross-cultural study in two different sites in person as a PhD student.
I mean, they happened. There were a lot of researchers that did pretty interesting and compelling and important work collaborating, but this study in specific was delayed a little bit. I mean, it happened. I'm going to talk more about it. But at first, we focused on, like, into the reality that we could, like, collect data, which was online. We still, like, explored these economic aspects that I was interested, but there was also the aspect of being in online environments. That was another question that popped out to us, and it turned out to be a big part of my PhD.
Oh, very cool. Yes, and that's always how research goes, right? Start with one idea and then adjust along the way as different things happen. And sometimes those happen to be a global pandemic, which makes you pivot and change your approach. It sounds like that initial motivation stayed consistent, just the approach and method had to shift a little bit according to lockdown and different things like that.
Yeah, that gave us, like, opportunity to explore questions that we weren't thinking before. But that are definitely, like, worth exploring. I think you also, in your question, you mentioned, like, why this was important.
Why are virtual environments so important?
So in the virtual environment, there are a few aspects that made the same interactions possible, but not the same way. Like, virtual interactions, they vary. They can vary a lot. For example, I can be, imagine that we are here on Zoom, for example, or Google Meet. This would be like a synchronous interaction, like I'm talking to you at this moment, you see what I'm doing, what I'm saying, and everything. But interactions could also be asynchronous, like, for example, if we're sending messages, emails, these kinds of things, or even, like, through pre-recorded stuff. So
sending voice notes or things
exactly.
like that. Yes, yeah.
Yeah. This can, like, this synchronicity and the social presence of the interaction can vary in online interactions in a way that, like, in person, not that much.
Yes, in person, it wouldn't be quite the same as saying something, pausing, and then waiting until the other person was able to access the voice note in person, right? You're just having a conversation.
Yeah.
There's not things that happen in between.
Yeah, and also in social behavior, imagine that, like, a big deal of, like, interactions and human relationships are also influenced by reputation. So if you see me doing something here, I will feel judged, for example. As I said in the beginning of our conversation, I am, like, ESL, like, English as second language person. And, like, if I say something that is, oh my gosh, I think I didn't say correctly or something, like, I'm gonna be a bit, okay, I need to fix that, blah, 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 which is, which is silly from me. But this is, like, the reputation aspect that I'm mentioning. Like, with synchronous, like, interactions, like, live interactions, there is more this component of reputation going on. And studies from, like, in-person settings with kids and adults as well, actually, show that when we are observed, we share more with others. And we want to appear, like, more generous, or we don't want others to, like, think bad of us or something like that. And then having an online interaction, sometimes you don't always feel observed. So that could be something that can modulate. The other thing is that growing up online, kids are also like developing their cognitive abilities to interact with the screen. Mm. And resources are not perceived the same way in a screen or in person. And this was a big point in my research mm-hmm. that gave me a lot of headache to analyze data, actually. I can talk more about that later, but basically these two aspects, like how kids would like over time interact with virtual resources and be willing or not to like share with others in an online environment. Mm-hmm. And if like the differences in the observation or like the synchronicity of the interaction would interfere with the way that kids were like deciding as well.
Oh, that's super interesting. And you mentioned, you were explaining like how perceptions of standing or your reputation are impacted. So how do children's perceptions of their own social status or their own understanding of their reputation influence how they share? And did anything surprise you about what you found?
Yeah, definitely. So studies with like taking a look at this, like at how economic status. And status can be like, for example, coming from a more, you did something, you did better than me, so like, you're above me in this like context here. Like, for example, I don't know, playing volleyball or something like that. Mm-hmm. But in this case, like status that we're talking about is comes from like economics
okay.
yeah. itself. Like, for example, comparison of education level mm-hmm. or comparison of annual income, let's mm-hmm. say, like a official, let's put like on course, like government kind of mark. And from that standpoint, a lot of research has explored objective status. So the difference is that objective status is the one that uses these kind of measures, like for example, income, education, mm-hmm. that are like official measures. Mm-hmm. But that can shift from what people perceive as their status.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I could be in an environment that is so unequal that I don't perceive that I am like not like in the gradient mm-hmm. of like income, for example. I'm not in the middle. I'm like way lower, for example. Or that I'm in the middle and I think that I'm way higher, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So social standing, like there are these two types of measures. And one of them is the subjective mm-hmm. way of looking at things. That's what I mentioned, like the perception.
So like if how everyone thinks they're middle class, regardless of what their income is, if you ask someone, they say, oh, where are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm middle class, whether or not they fit. You
what
know.
Middle class?
Exactly. yes. Like where that. Does that fit? But so people's perception of where they are versus those official markers, like what shows up on your income tax or what shows up.
Perfect.
Yes. That kind of thing. Okay. Yeah. No, it makes sense.
Research has focused much more on like creating an artificial status, like I was talking at you, like being better at a task mm-hmm. or I don't know, like, okay, you're going to be middle class today. You're going to be high class, mm-hmm. something like that, like manipulating the mm-hmm. status markers or using the objective, like asking questionnaires and asking people to like put their annual income, for example, but has not focused that much, even in adults with subjective status.
Mm.
And subjective feelings can be more like research, which is like pretty recent, by the way, but research has been showing that subjective status can actually sometimes be more informative about a few social behaviors because it can like deal with the feelings that the person have of like, for example, pride, merit, deservingness, all these kinds of things. And also how like people decide to share because they are immersed in like in a community that's interdependent.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to look into subjective status exactly because it's understudied, especially in children. And it has an interesting pattern of development in children. So children in the beginning, like when they're young, they think they are in a much higher status than they are.
mm-hmm.
So if you ask a small child, like a young child, okay, where do you think you are here? Like if you present, for example, the paradigm of MacArthur, which is like a ladder and there are 10 rungs, and ask them, okay, imagine that this is the society.
Mm-hmm.
And people like in the bottom rung, they would have like jobs that pay less, they had less things. And then people in the top rung would be like the best off, like with the best jobs, better reputation, all these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Usually young children, they are like, oh, I'm the top, of course.
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this can be due to the fact that they have less perspectives on wealth in general.
Mm-hmm.
and they need to like understand what they have, what others have, what they don't have, things like that. So research by scholars like Rebecca Peretz-Lange and Tara Mandalaiwala has shown that kids, they have this like this higher perspective, actually, as with a young age. And some researchers, like, for example, Dorsa Emir, has shown that this type of paradigm, when it's like shown to kids, they show a really interesting pattern like through development, which is like an inverse relationship between age and subjective social status. Mm. So we found the exact same thing. And we adapted that paradigm. Like, we did something more like, I mean, it's still graphical, like the ladder thing that I mentioned, but we transformed into like little houses of increasing sizes.
Okay.
And then we found the exact same pattern. Like, kids younger than 7, 8 years old, they have a pretty optimistic way to see their own status. And then as they pass through middle childhood, which is also an important landmark for sharing, they start to be a bit more realistic about the status.
Mm. They start to see their perspective aligned, their subjective perspective aligns more with maybe some of those objective markers as they age.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And with this kind of developing sense of status that kids are creating for themselves, what does this mean for their sharing or their sharing behavior?
Yeah, this is like, I think, like, in my personal opinion, the most interesting finding of my PhD. We found that by analyzing like the way that kids were like giving in this game that we created and using this perception of status as a predictor, like to try to like find where the relationship was going, like in terms of like how they perceive status and how they're sharing them, we found that actually there is sort of an inverse relationship.
Mm.
So kids that were perceiving themselves as having more, they gave less in the game.
Oh, interesting.
And less equitably as well. So equitably, we consider like giving half of the resources. For example, we have 10 resources, like 10 golden coins in this game that we created. And being equitable would mean like giving 5, for example. And this would be like towards someone who is like with them, like an experimenter who's like interacting with them live. Mm. Or with a pre-recorded adult that's like interacting with them as well. So we created these two conditions. And we saw that like kids that were observed, like that were like interacting directly with the adult experimenter, they shared more. So these also corroborated something that we found online. And kids that were, that had lower status, like shared more coins. And kids that had higher status shared less. So this is what I found on my PhD. Then, as I mentioned, that like I was interested in doing this international collaboration, especially because we think that aspects of perception of status and inequality might be different in places that have high inequality. And then we collaborated with two universities in Brazil. One was the one that I did my undergrad, which was really fulfilling. And also another university, so it would be Universidade Federal do Rio Grande do Norte in the northeast of Brazil. And Universidade Federal do Pará, which would be in the north, close to the Amazon forest.
Okay.
So we had kids from like diverse socioeconomic status participating. I mean, also here in Canada, we got a bit more of diversity than what we usually get with like in-person studies. A little bit more, not that much. In Brazil, we also had like different statuses, but that was constrained by the fact that families needed to have internet access. So that's like also, there was diversity, but we could have more. So for that reason, maybe we need to interpret these results as well, thinking about that. But we found the same relationship in Brazil.
Interesting.
So also kids in Brazil that perceive themselves as higher status also shared less in our game. So it's cool to see that like a behavior in like a specific environment is already like capturing a few aspects of society, could be capturing a few aspects of society and was observed like cross-culturally.
Oh, that's very interesting. Especially, yes, so I wonder how kids are learning this, right? Like, and I'm sure, I know you've got lots of ideas for future studies coming up. What does this tell us about how children develop pro-social behavior then, if they they start to build an understanding of maybe where their status, their family status truly lies? What does that tell us about how they're developing?
Yeah, this is super interesting because we all know that like young kids, they have a hard time sharing with others. And this is normal because there is something that develops through time, which is inequity aversion. And this aspect is like the first thing that develops is like the disadvantageous version of inequity aversion. So you being adverse, like you being like, okay, I don't like that about you being in disadvantage. Like even animals show that. Like if people like did experiments, like Michael Tomasello, for example, did experiments, and kids and chimps were like really like not happy about the fact that they received less snacks or less stickers, for example. And they were able to see, like, for example, that other child or chimp received more than them and be not happy about it. But then, like, something interesting happens in middle childhood. Like, of course, all the things come into play, like, for example, reputation that I mentioned. Like, around 5 years of age, kids start to like be aware of their actions and try to look better for others, not only with sharing but other types of prosocial behavior, like helping and like comforting others, for example. But around middle childhood, something interesting happens that is absorbing social norms. So people start to like, okay, I need to act like the adults of my society, what is considered the correct thing, because this is fair. So this is like the advantageous inequity aversion, like, starts to be true here, like, starts to be the thing, because kids start to feel bad about receiving more than others. Not in every situation, but, like, spontaneously. Because before that, like, before middle childhood, usually kids are only, like, equitable, they're only like sharing the same amounts is correct when they like are prompted by adults or by older kids, for example. I mean, hey, you should share more with your little brother.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Yes, very anecdotally, I have young nieces right now, and I see this behavior all the time, right? Someone gets a toy, the other person is immediately upset if they don't have access to the toy, but if the situation's reversed, they're hesitant to share it first until there's some coaxing from adults or older children that they're playing with. Like, oh, why don't you give so-and-so a turn? And then they'll reluctantly agree. But as they're getting older, those struggles are less and less as they're learning. So anecdotally at all, I think a lot of listeners can who have, you know, young children in their lives can definitely appreciate what you're saying and see that can see that happening in their interactions. So they start to shift and absorb, like you said, the norms of adults. So they start to change and they're worried about how they're perceived by others, if they're being perceived as good or bad or generous or not generous, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we knew all of that from like in-person research. And there was little evidence at the time. Nowadays, there is more because there was more like research conducted online because of the pandemic as well. But there was little evidence on like how these behaviors expressed in the online environment. Exactly because of the things that I talked about, like there is less observation, like less reputation cues in some types of interaction. But also because things like the way that kids perceive these resources that they want or not, like in a screen, are different from what they would have like with tangible resources, for example.
For example, like it's a lot harder correct me if I'm wrong, but a kid with candy, for example, right in front of them understands quite quickly what that is and what that resource might be. But online sharing tokens or whatever online currency might not translate the same to their understanding of value compared to something that's right in front of them that they can immediately touch and access or snack on in the case of candy, that kind of thing. Is that correct?
Yeah, things start to be more real when kids start to like interact more within online worlds, like, for example, in video games. So, for example, I'm playing a video game and like having this like fun and like engaging interaction, you start to like value these resources. So in neuroeconomics, there is, and in economics as well, of course, there is this valuation aspect that's like how much this matters to you. And that might be a thing in our study that was a limitation, actually, that we weren't able to measure how much their young kids were like valuing these resources and opened up as well questions for further research. How much that was impacting the way that they chose to share, because what we've seen in our research was that in person there is like usually a line that like increases over time of how much children are sharing, so a linear positive relationship. And what we saw was a U-shaped relationship. So young kids that usually don't share a lot of like candy, stickers or tokens, even in person, like in laboratory or naturalistic settings, they were like for some reason giving out a lot.
Oh, interesting.
Of tokens in our study. So what we did was that we created a video game in our lab that actually I programmed and illustrated this video game.
Oh, very cool. Yeah.
Which can also showcase that, like, sometimes in psychology, you can, like, apply many different I mean, science in general, you can apply and transfer different skills mm-hmm. to make different things work for for your research. But we created a video game in which kids completed activities. They gained these tokens that we told them they could like buy a prize at the end in a virtual store. Mm-hmm. So we did our best to like control for how much kids have interacted in the past with tokens or online currencies by asking questions about these types of things in the questionnaire for parents. But also we try to like sell these coins and say they're like, oh, they're great. Like you're going to buy these types of prizes in the end. Do you want to play? And they're like, oh, of course. And all of this. Mm-hmm. But still, like, this question remained to us because the young kids in the online settings, they were giving more coins than what we expected. And this is something that I said that was a nightmare to analyze, exactly because that's not the pattern that we usually find in developmental studies. So we were like, okay, here we have something different. We have a few like hypotheses on why this is happening, but it's definitely different from in person.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And then you said it was a U-curve, so I assume that means younger children are sharing a lot and then it decreases as they age and then increases again at another certain age point?
So around 6 years old, like they have this dip.
Okay.
In the curve. And then they start again like around like eight, like middle childhood, as I said. That aspect we could like argument at this point that was due, for example, for absorption of social norms. And that makes sense and something that we corroborated in the online environment, which was really cool. But the pattern of young kids was still like mesmerizing to us. And as I said, we have a few hypotheses on why this happened. It can be due to the valuation aspect that I mentioned, that these young kids, they don't understand well yet these the value of these coins in an online environment, or can be due to like more cognitive aspects of planning and understanding that a 2D thing that's on a screen values something.
Yes, they haven't quite. Perhaps the abstract value is hard for them to conceptualize at that point. Would that be?
Yeah.
Yes.
Also that, but even like understanding that these quantities in a screen are the same quantities of something, like if the tokens, real tokens existed in front of them. So there can be other reasons for sure. And that's something that we are interested in, like taking a better look at it now and like writing about it as well, because there's not a lot of research done on how kids conceptualize digital currencies. A lot of research on that is on user experience, actually, on like computation, but it's more like exploratory. In a sense of like having, for example, a group of kids interacting with like a software or like a currency and then like doing a report on how these kids explore, which is super valid. But from the psychology perspective, we also need to design some studies to better understand how this like understanding like how this conceptualization of digital currencies happen and learning about it, learning about this value.
Oh, that's very interesting because, I mean, so much of what we're doing is in the virtual world these days. So why does understanding sharing in virtual contexts matter for the broader world? And what implications might your research have beyond the lab?
Yeah, this is the question. Like as researchers, like we always have to be thinking about like how our research is translating to like actionable items. And as people that do like basic science, which is like science that it's not like applied at this time directly on something, we sometimes, okay, what's the like, what's my contribution? Right? What's my contribution here? I saw an interesting aspect here, but how does that like impact what we're going to see like in the next few years or like how can I help anything in general in the humanity? So this is like an existential crisis that sometimes we have like as researchers that even in the applied sciences, I think that people would feel like that. So research like that can inform, for example, how we can think and start to design online applications. First of all, like seeing the media thing. Exactly, because we're seeing that the young kids are not understanding currency the same way, probably are not understanding currency the same way as the older kids. And then by designing like educational applications and video games and communities and things that are like, for example, extensions of the classroom or like practice for them with like digital abilities and all of this. And just video games in general, maybe things that are like designed for younger kids need to be designed in a different manner for them to understand the value that things have. And as well, like broader in a broader sense to the society, we could see like that, like how these perceptions of status within social communities online already are unfolding, could be unfolding, like different ways in what people are like interacting as kids, and that they like perpetuate these patterns for a lot of years and get to the adult life, and how we can like design interventions, education interventions, or like parenting interventions as well for kids, in the sense of like thinking about building societies with more fairness, for example.
No, it makes a lot of sense, right? That seeing, you know, younger children interacting on a platform where there's all ages of children or adults, you know, they might need some other safety features or different things, or parents need to be aware and monitoring that, because their kids are gonna, their younger kids will interact much differently than maybe an older kid. And I think of some of the examples of news headlines in the past, you know, where you see a kid getting access to an account, a game account that's linked to a parent's credit card, and not understanding, you know, the value of in-game purchases in real life and those types of
Absolutely.
Things, right? Where you see a kid has spent, you know, $1,000 or more, you know, on a parent's credit card for virtual currency or, you know, virtual skins or something like that in a game, because they don't quite make that connection the same way that
maybe this is real money.
Exactly. That an older kid would, right? So maybe building those things in.
Sometimes for older kids also like have a hard time, but So for example, using this research to help us how to design educational interventions for financial education in kids, it's also like something that can be applied here, and it seems like obvious and direct for me.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense as more and more of our world moves on into digital spaces, right? We need support for kids to follow as well as they also enter these spaces. And I know you mentioned that you actually designed, coded, and illustrated the video game that kids were interacting in your study. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your other creative hobbies? Because it sounds like you have quite a background in creative things and different hobbies. So can you tell us a little bit more about your illustration and some of the other creative things you get up to outside of the lab?
Yeah, I have a big passion for like arts in general. Since I was a kid, I really liked like drawing and doing like creative stuff in general. And I was always kind of torn between like choosing a career in the creative path or in the science path, because I also loved science since like middle school or something. And then I was like, okay, there is like a point in between here, which is science communication, which is something I really like, and I try to have as like a side aspect of my professional development. So I have been like involved directly in initiatives for like recruitments, like Science Rendezvous, for example, designing materials, and within as well our department, not our department, but like a group in our department, which is the Child and Adolescent Development Group, Instagram profile, and our lab Instagram profile. So I have been like volunteering, collaborating with that, like with creating content and creating like original illustrations, for example, for material for like children engagement, like in recruitment or just like science outreach in general, like Science Rendezvous, as I mentioned, or the series of talks that happened past few years ago, which was Growing Up Human at the Kingston Library.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, I like my passion for the arts like helps me also like find a way of communicating what I'm talking about with others. And I think like sometimes, one time my supervisor said, okay, you have to explore that, because this is a superpower.
She's right. Yes.
And
no.
That's all to say that like it is something that it's like unique, like something that is unique about you. Like, for example, in my case, it's like illustration and the arts, something that I really like, can be still applied to like your career in a different path. That's what I'm talking about. And just in general, I enjoy like creative things like illustration, as I said, and I love crochet and like textiles in general. Yeah, I also have a band that's like in a bit of hiatus, but we really like playing just for like us ourselves, just like
just
jamming.
Yeah, that's awesome. What type of music do you play when your band is back together?
Yeah, we play some Brazilian music, but really, really like pop, punk, rock, these kinds of things. Like, as a millennial, was a teenager when like the emo was on the height, I really like, for example, we like playing like Green Day and these kinds of things, Arctic Monkeys.
Oh, very fun.
We play covers. We don't have originals yet, just for funsies.
No, just for fun, though. That is so super fun. Well, Sylvia, it has been so great chatting with you. Thank you for doing the show, and best of luck with the rest of your research as you continue to explore.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Questions, and we'd love to have you back as your studies develop and hear more about, you know, what you're finding as you explore some of those questions that came from your research.
I will be happy to do that. Thank you so much.
So that is it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.